This is Dr. Robert C. Newman in his course on the Synoptic Gospels, lecture number 1B on miracles.
In our last session, we were discussing various liberal lives of Christ. We want to now do a summary on some of the principles we can learn about that and some responses to it. So, summary on the liberal lives of Christ. I think we can say, first of all, the guiding principle of liberal reconstructions is the rejection of miraculous. This is not a necessary principle to such reconstruction, but it's currently standard. One could use, for instance, Spiritism, you know, where you get Jesus studying under a Tibetan guru or something of that sort. But modern scholarship, at least, still considers this trash at present. So whether that will continue or not, I don't know. Well, if miraculous doesn't occur or is rejected, then fulfilled prophecy is dismissed as one of the following sorts of things. Later invention. Okay? It's obviously easy to make very impressive prophecies if you're writing after the events and then pretending they occurred earlier. We see some of that in the Book of Mormon, I believe, where you have a rather impressive predictions of Columbus and the Indians and the Puritans and that sort of thing, but no evidence the book was written before 1830. So, where are we? Intentional fulfillment. That person could say, I'm going to the store tomorrow. And they go to the store tomorrow. And yeah, it's a fulfilled prediction, but not terribly impressive. some would take Jesus riding into Jerusalem on the donkey in that particular category, and there's some sense in which that is okay, but the problem is, can you explain all that sort of thing that way? The prophecy was vague, okay? That can be resorted to. Or the fulfillment is misinterpreted, and that's kind of a standard phenomenon today. So probably the two commonest ones you will see in liberal circles today is the fulfillment was invented later, or the fulfillment is just a misinterpretation of something that really didn't intend that at all. Well, miracle accounts then are going to be handled somewhat similarly. What corresponds to later invention, if you like, in explaining away fulfilled prophecies would be that these events didn't actually happen. Somebody wrote these miracles into a story of Jesus long after, and nothing of the sort happened. Huh? Staged. We've already seen in looking through some of the liberal lives of Christ the reference to staged miracles of some sort, which we'd call fraud of some sort. Hmm? Misinterpreted natural event is, in fact, the way Paulus was handling the things. Jesus walking up the hill into the clouds, or embarrassed people sharing their 2,500 lunches with the other 2,500 people or something of that sort. And then last one under miracle accounts is faith healing. And we saw again in the liberal lives of Christ how that was rather common. So this is kind of the guiding principle, rejection of the miraculous. What's the resulting attitude? A resulting attitude towards the biblical material is progressive skepticism. So first you see them rejecting the theological explanations, such as we see in Paul and Peter and John's epistles, and then in the Gospel of John, etc., and then gradually getting into seeing all these miracles and having to explain them away. But even when you've gotten down to Mark, you've got miracles, okay? So we'll see when we discuss Bultmann's form criticism, which is near the end of our course here, that he finally, after reducing miracles to their simplest form, has to throw them out as not having occurred because he doesn't believe in the miraculous. However, as we had mentioned earlier, that Renan had pointed out the kind of enigma that you see with the miracles taken out of Jesus, so that he then began to sort various characteristics of Jesus into the ethical teacher of righteousness and the revolutionary and the martyr, etc. the resulting picture of Jesus is a historical enigma if the miracles were removed. If Jesus never existed, like we would think of, say, Paul Bunyan or somebody like that, and as the communists often claimed Jesus, then the question is, where did all the historical evidence come from? How did it pop up in four or five different sources and that sort of thing, huh? If he existed but he's only a fraud. Where did the ethical teaching come from? That's going to be a question, huh? After all, you've got some very impressive ethical teaching in the Gospels, and that has engaged philosophers and ethicists and theologians for many, many centuries. Mm. If Jesus was only a gentle teacher of righteousness, why did he receive all the opposition, particularly from the particular sources? The Pharisees were really interested in right living, if you like. You can understand maybe more from the Sadducees or something of that sort, huh? So why did he receive all the opposition, particularly from those sources? If Jesus was only a revolutionary, where did all the non-revolutionary teaching come from? And how can the moral teaching of Jesus be reconciled with his messianic claims apart from the biblical explanation? This is C.S. Lewis's trilemma, huh? Jesus was either a lord, either lunatic, liar, or lord, okay? And how do you handle that sort of thing? If Jesus is not supernatural, then we must leave out one part of the data to construct a consistent personality model for the human-only Jesus. And you're seeing even the post-Bultmannians are coming across that kind of problem. Why does he seem to be humble and submitted and yet feel that he is unique and that sort of thing? Whenever you claim that some aspect of this data has to be thrown out, you really have to explain how it got there and how it got there early. Okay? How did that happen? That's one of the complications regarding the deity of Jesus. As J. Gresham Machen pointed out earlier in the 20th century, that the picture of Jesus as being more than human shows up in the most Jewish parts of the Gospels. And how did it get there? Okay. Well, this usually requires us to insert some kind of a secret plot theory into Jesus' life, or to have to insert some kind of unknown genius into early Christianity. And it presumes that the Gospels are basically unreliable. But if Jesus is the God-man Messiah, who has also come to demonstrate what sin is and point it out to people, then Jesus' multifaceted personality and actions make sense. The Gospels are reliable. Craig Blomberg, remember the book I mentioned earlier, The Historical Reliability of the Gospels, shows that if it's not assumed in advance that miracles can't occur, then the Gospels look very impressive indeed. And I think that's well worth reading that over. So that really brings us back to the question, is it really true that miracles cannot occur? Or are the arguments against the miraculous valid? Well, that's the primary issue then, in some sense, to which the New Testament historicity reduces. If miracles can occur, then the New Testament gives every evidence of reliable history. If miracles cannot happen, then the New Testament is unreliable, and the liberals may be justified in leaving out whatever New Testament data do not fit it. Well, let's look at some arguments against the miraculous. I'm going to start out with a deductive argument, first of all, an a priori argument. I have not seen this one in print formally, but it does seem to color liberal arguments. It takes this form. A miracle is a violation of natural law. Well, what does it mean to violate natural law? Well, it might mean to commit a sin, or to commit a logical fallacy, or to commit an aesthetic blunder. And God cannot commit fallacies. He's not going to sin. He's not going to blunder aesthetically. Therefore, God cannot do miracles. You kind of have this implied often, huh? Note this argument doesn't work against satanic miracles. You know, Satan can sin, can blunder aesthetically, etc. But, yes. Well, the logical structure of this argument is sound, but we have to examine the content of the propositions. Is a miracle necessarily a violation of natural law? Well, that's a good question. Here I've got a pen, and I sit it here on my paper. And the natural law is that gravity is holding the pin down, and the electromagnetic forces that make up solids are keeping the thing from going through the paper and the desk and the table, so it stays right there. But lo and behold, the pin rises from the table. What has happened? Well, I haven't violated any natural laws. I have intervened and caused some things to happen that wouldn't have happened otherwise. Huh? So lifting a pin like that is not a violation of the law of gravity. It is true, however, that miracles as a violation of natural law have been used by Christians as common definition of miracle, so that I'm not going to fault that too badly. But my read would be that some miracles intervene in natural laws and bring another force into play, if you like. Some of them, I mean, like the creation of the universe or something, seem to, I don't know, violate it, but at least override it or supersede it or something of that sort. There is, of course, ambiguity in the term law when the deductive argument claims that to violate natural law is a sin. Sin, in fact, implies a moral law, not a natural law. And fallacy implies a logical law, not a natural law. And blunder implies an aesthetic law, if you like. But are we justified in mixing moral precepts with physical constraints? Does breaking a physical law necessarily imply moral sin has occurred or any of these others? Huh? Perhaps physical law doesn't fall in any of these categories, and to violate a physical law is to commit a miracle, okay? And it's not clear that that's a real problem. Huh? So it's an ambiguity natural law, in, or an ambiguity law, if you like, in the second statement. Even if we grant the first statement, violation of natural law, and even say to violate a natural law is to sin, if you like, or something like that, it's clear that the Bible contains moral laws which are intended only for man. And God can, quote, violate them in some sense, okay? So humans are not to take vengeance. But God says, vengeance is mine, okay? He can take it, all right? So, and God can, in some sense, kill humans in various circumstances, that if we were to do that, that would be wrong for us to do that. And those really say there are certain sins that relate to us arrogating what God has restricted to himself. I remember even the situation where Uzziah goes into the temple to offer incense, which the priest could offer, but the king wasn't supposed to offer. Okay, so laws can often take that kind of form, if you like. So God can command us to worship him because of who he is, but we should not command people to worship us. Thus, the Bible has a precedent for what we might call person-dependent laws. What's a violation for us may not be a violation for God, as that law does not apply to him. It's dangerous to limit or judge God by our standards. So the deductive argument is not conclusive, especially if miracles are connected with God as one of his attributes. Since we cannot safely explore the supernatural on our own, arguing with revelation about it basically leaves us in the dark. Sometimes people argue that the biblical picture of God is inferior because it pictures God as needing to tinker with his universe. If God were really great, he would have made natural laws better so that he would not need to interfere with them. Well, as I already hinted earlier in my previous lecture, this assumes that God desired to create a universe which was fully automatic. Perhaps he desired to create a universe which allowed for his self-expression. Contrast a clock with a guitar. Eh? Okay, that's the deductive argument. Let's try an inductive argument, a very famous inductive argument by David Hume. Okay, his is the most famous and influential of these. Here's how it goes. One, when someone tells us of an event, we tend to accept the report or be skeptical of it in proportion to the degree that it's unusual. Two, by definition, a miracle is a very rare and unusual event, and our uniform experience dictates against the miraculous. Thus, we should be very skeptical about any reports of miracles. Three, the means by which we know something is our experience of the world. Since miracles go against this and upset our uniform experience, we tend to explain them by some naturalistic means, unless that explanation would itself be more unusual than accepting a miracle. So that's sort of Hume's argument, if you like. And then he shifts from an argument to a program. Four, thus when a miracle is reported, we should reject it unless any naturalistic explanation would be even more unusual. Well, let's analyze that. The first one, someone tells the event, we tend to accept it or reject it on the to the degree that it's unusual. That's certainly true. Our skepticism does increase, as one claims to have seen or met X yesterday, as X shifts from, say, one of the teachers in your school to the President of the United States or Queen Elizabeth, something like that, or to Martin Luther, someone who's dead, or to Jesus, okay? So you're more skeptical when you hear these more unusual reports. Number 2A, by definition, a miracle is very rare and unusual event. That's correct, okay? Bible says that miracles are very rare events. We should tend to be skeptical of reports of them, okay? But 2B, our uniform experience dictates against the miraculous, is incorrect. Hume has shifted the definition of miracle from a rare event to an impossible event. His conclusion is thus the result of a circular argument. After all, whose uniform experience is Hume considering? There are people who claim to have seen miracles, okay? Over what time period? How many individuals is he including? To try to use uniform experience of all humanity would not work, as some people report they have seen miracles. This is true even in modern times. We have non-sympathetic reports of occult miracles in the literature. Take Fatima, take spontaneous human combustion. Look that one up on Google if you're interested in what that's all about. It's a more general problem. If we assume that miracles do occur, this methodology tells us to explain them away anyhow. Thus, the argument must be inadequate, since it does not include a method to test their possible occurrence. C.S. Lewis responds to the uniform experience argument in his book Miracles, my edition, pages 122 to 124. John Warwick Montgomery discusses it in his book Christianity for the Tough-Minded, page 42. Uniform experience is a poor argument, as there may be a whole realm of reality which we cannot sense and which must be revealed to us by revelation, as a deaf or blind person must depend on revelation for the sense they lack. So that's Hume's argument against the miraculous. Let's move to another one of these kind of arguments, and that's Adolf Harnack's argument in What is Christianity? The Harper Torchback edition, pages 24 and 25. He says, we do not need to accept miracles because they're based on primitive ignorance. And here's how the argument goes. In New Testament times, miracles were thought to be commonplace. Andrew Dixon White, in his book, History of the Warfare Between Science and Science and Theology in Christendom, argues this sort of thing at great length. The problem, the reactions of people in the New Testament accounts show they did not expect miraculous interventions, that they were ho-hum events. When Jesus begins doing miracles, huge crowds begin to flock, okay? Would they flock to him if those were everyday events and that they had seen, one every day of their life? Huh? The disciples do not typically expect Jesus to work a miracle to get them out of a jam. Feeding the 5,000, be unexpected. The storm at sea. They wanted to do something. I'm not sure what they wanted to do, but they're certainly amazed when what he did do happened. Huh? New Testament people, as they always marvel when miracles occur, and they have trouble drawing simple lessons from them. This implies they did not view them as common or even as expected. Harnack argues from reports in secular literature that miracle accounts were common in New Testament period. These are not as well attested nor as clear as New Testament accounts, but we should not rule out some of these, as the Bible itself allows, for miracles by satanic power. The remarks about, accounts in Exodus of the magicians trying to match Moses, and they begin to draw some strong things when they can't match the gnats, if you like, and such. So we must be careful in deciding what can or cannot occur on the basis of our preconceptions. An example of that, late 18th century scientists in France and America, including Thomas Jefferson, refused to believe that stones fell from the sky, because only peasants and priests reported seeing them. But eventually turned out that stones do fall from the sky. They're called meteors, okay? We have lots of them in our museums now. The second point that Harnack made was New Testament people did not know enough science to recognize a miracle when they saw one, page 25. Well, this appeals to our pride in high technology. Much of our advancing technology does look miraculous to primitives. I have here radio, telephone, computers, etc., but there's been a lot of etc. Since I first made these lectures, if you like. So, however, can we now explain away Jesus' miracles by means of high technology? Walking on the water? Was he really riding on a hovercraft and they didn't notice the craft and all the racket it made? Okay, so we at least don't have any technology to explain how that sort of thing happened. New Testament people knew which diseases did not heal suddenly. Blindness, death, leprosy, crippled limbs, etc. People today still cannot explain these methods. These miracles with technology. Considered Mark 6, walking on water. Mark 7, the deaf and mute healed. Mark 8, the feeding of the 4,000. Huh? It's impressive that Jesus did just these types of miracles, which still stump us in the 21st century. Well, so there are some real problems with arguments against the miraculous. What does acceptance of the miraculous do to scientific history or to science in general? Many historians and scientists are scared of miracle because they think that then the whole bottom drops out of their work. My job is to explain reality, and this would introduce a whole new realm. Scientific historians feel there should be no miraculous interventions needed to explain history. Well, adding miracles does add a new dimension to reality for many people. I'm not sure I've experienced any miracles. I've had some fairly impressive answers to prayer, but not sure I've seen anything that would explicitly claim as miracle. History has thus been explained, if you might, quotes around it, without miracles. But we don't know whether the explanations are true, since we can't check them. We don't have time machines, huh? What difference does adding miracles make to explaining history, huh? Well, first, it makes an enormous difference on the scale of ultimate explanation. If there's a God who intervenes, then history is certainly going to be affected on a large scale. God and other supernatural beings introduce the possibility of new purposes and new goals in history, which we might not otherwise know about or be able to figure out from down here inside history. What difference miracles make on a small scale will depend on the actual frequency of miracles at that particular time and place. It may be that there's points in history when miracles were happening, but they were not important historically. I would suggest from biblical warrant that regeneration is miraculous, and it does affect history, but it's not the sort of thing that's like multiplying the loaves and the fishes or opening the Red Sea or something of that sort. There may be points in history where miracles are extremely important for understanding the events. Miracles, of course, do add another variable for use in constructing models, but it doesn't follow that this variable must be invoked at every gap any more than any other mode of explanation must be invoked in every gap. There are already plenty of difficult-to-assess variables in understanding history. Individual personalities, backgrounds, motivations, economics, etc. We can't get inside a person to see their motivations. We know motivations exist because we're inside ourselves, but we can't see the others, okay? Well, we don't have to invoke a miracle whenever an event occurs, which we cannot explain. I have a PowerPoint talk on the miraculous, don't remember the title of it right at the moment, which does suggest principles for recognizing miracles and that sort of thing. Well, I'll say a word about it since we're here, okay? I can't reproduce the whole talk. I look at the biblical terms used for miracles, and since my Hebrew is not great, I'm primarily looking at the Greek terms for miracles. And you have dunamis, which means power. So a miracle is a work involving unusual power of some sort. Well, that may not be the physical term of energy per unit time, but power, okay? There's the two terms, thauma and teros, which speak of miracle as something wonderful, amazing, marvelous, that sort of thing. And so we think of miracle as something marvelous. And then there's the third term, semeion, which thinks of miracle as significant, okay? And so suggestions should be probably our default is we don't invoke miracles under normal circumstances, but if we see evidence of an event that is sufficiently powerful, marvelous, and even significant in some way, that may suggest that a miracle is the best explanation of that particular event. Liberals have often argued that miraculous is irrational, if you like, but from a biblical perspective, miraculous is not irrational because it's the action of a rational being. And in God's case, he's the most rational being, if you like, and it's usually accompanied by revelation. Some people, as I say, object that miracles add an irrational element to history. This they mean it adds an element which they can't predict what it will do. That does destroy the historian's dream of being able to predict the future, but the Christian realizes that something irrational is not being added. Now, the mind is involved. God's mind is rational. Through revelation, God explains what he's doing in his miracles before and after the event. Satan, of course, may or may not tell us what he's doing, and he's not trustworthy in any case, and sin and sinful minds are irrational, okay, but God is not. So satanic miracles may be irrational, but in dealing with the motivation of sinful humans, we already have plenty of irrational in history. Without even imagining miracles, you've got plenty of irrational things happening in history. In fact, the miraculous itself is the revelation of the unseen supernatural person, namely God, when he's the miracle worker, just as human activity is a revelation of the unseen inner person. Note the parallel activities of God and man. We can look at the outside of other people and we see what they're doing, but we have to infer their motives and we may be wrong. Okay, we can look at history and see what's going on and we can try to infer God's motives and we may be wrong. Okay, the book of Job is a very powerful picture of this as the God and Satan are acting in the unseen world, and Job and his friends are observing what's happening out there, and all of them botch it up, okay? Because they don't see what's going on, huh? The miraculous certainly solves a lot of problems in biblical history as well as in natural prehistory. Liberals, as we've seen, have not been able to make sense of Jesus without miracles. But with miracles, Jesus and the rest of Scripture make sense. Make sense in how the disciples came to believe in the resurrection. Actually happened. It actually happened. It's not so hard to see how they believed it, okay? They weren't making guesses about an empty tomb. They were witnessing Jesus, It explains where the elaborate ritual, moral, and legal code of the Pentateuch came from, Liberals have to spread this over 1,000 years and still have some troubles there. Make sense of fulfilled prophecies, especially the coming of Jesus. Also, natural prehistory is explained. Origin of life, origin of the earth, origin of the universe, etc. Brings us to one last category we want to talk about here just a bit, and that is, what are we to make of liberal reconstructions of the life of Jesus? Well, this may sound very gauche, but they're Satan's work. C.S. Lewis captures this very nicely in his Screwtape Letters. I have a Macmillan paperback, and that's page 105 to 109, and then the old hardback edition, 116 to 118, is the chapter there in Screwtape. Screwtape, if you've read the book, you remember, is a senior devil, and he's writing to his nephew. I'm not sure how these relations work out in the demonic realm. Wormwood, and Screwtape describes how to keep people distracted from the real Jesus. And he says, have them search for the historical Jesus, and have them write a new life of Jesus every year. And that's been going on before Lewis wrote the book, and has been going on since Lewis wrote the book. Such work, says Screwtape, is called brilliant in literary circles, and you can see that from some of the hype over the Gospel of Judas and the the Da Vinci Code and the Tomb of Jesus and all these things that have come up in recent years, etc. Such work is called brilliant in literary circles, but is based on the type of guesswork which would be ruinous in business, betting on horses and things of that sort. This distraction from the real Jesus is a modern form of idolatry, since they make up their own Jesus. You might ask, why does God permit this? Deuteronomy 13, verses 1 through 5, discusses why the Lord would allow false prophets to arise. Parallel in that culture, if you like, to liberals arising with new Jesuses in this culture. He says, Moses speaking, well, it's the Lord speaking through Moses. He says, this is a test for people to see whether they love the God who exists in comparison with the gods of human invention, who often look more attractive or more tolerant of their sin. The world and its history is a testing ground to demonstrate to humans that we are as bad as God says we are, and that only His mercy can save us. A nice discussion of the reality of music, reality of miracles, from a evangelical perspective, is given in the book by Doug Guyvett and Gary Habermas, In Defense of Miracles, A Comprehensive Case for God's Action in History, InterVarsity, 1997. Well, with that, we end our first unit here, which is the historical Jesus. We don't have time machines. to throw away the Gospels is to throw away our 3-4 primary sources about the material. We will look at some material inside the Gospels, obviously, Synoptic Gospels, further on in our course here. And there's lots of apologetic material out there. Naturally, I tend to recommend our stuff in the IBRI website, www.ibri.org, where we try and deal with the evidence in nature for the existence of God, and then try and look at historical reliability. But there's good material out there, but there's bad material out there as well. And we're going to try at least to give you some warnings regarding the first, the bad, and some encouragement regarding the good. Thank you very much.
This is Dr. Robert C. Newman in his course on the Synoptic Gospels, lecture number 1B on miracles.